Well, I don't know. Maybe a steak.
Oh, a steak. About that thick and real juicy.
Yeah, right.
And not too done. Oh, right. Say. It's so near dinner time, too, and here we sit talking about things that are 10,000 miles away. Well, let's talk to the folks a minute. Tell them what you'd like to tell them.
Well, just hello to dad and sister and brothers, and I hope they're fine. Yes, I'm making okay.
Have you always had that little mustache?
Well, no.
It's pretty cute. Looks like Rudolph Valentino. Well, thanks a whole lot. You slip away now, and we'll try one of the other boys. That was Faustino Estrada, Williams, Arizona, Mrs. E.H. Estrada's son. Now, Billy J. Hill of Miami. Billy, how you been doing?
Well, about as good as can be expected in a place like this.
You don't look tall enough to be in the Army.
Well, I wish I wasn't.
Don't they put some kind of a restriction on your height before they let you in?
Yes, 5 foot, and I just hit the mark.
Right on the beam, huh? How do you like this part of the world? Have you seen enough out here to be glad you came, or do you wish you'd never come out here?
I wish I'd never been here. I like the States better.
Oh, well, who doesn't? After all, the final preference would certainly take us all back to the States. How many points do you have?
59.
That isn't enough, is it?
No, it isn't.
When did you join the 32nd?
In November of 43.
Was that during the Guinea campaign?
No, it was just in time to get a hold of it.
Oh, you were then in a part of it, all right.
Yes, I started out at Sador Beach Landing.
And you got into that mud at Leyte in first-class style, huh?
Yes.
Gee, that stuff must have been terrible. I've seen lots of pictures of it, and it must have been really rough.
It was just about knee-deep all over the island.
All the
time. Rained
every
day.
Well, it's been better up here, hasn't it, on Luzon?
Yes, it's considerable better. The weather here is much better than that.
Have you been enjoying good health?
Yes, I can say I have.
No wounds?
No. Pretty lucky at that.
Let's say something to the folks at home in a personal sort of way.
Well, I'd like to say hello for Raymond Wimberly's folks in Pima, Arizona, and to Evan Billingsley there in Miami. Someday I'm going to be back there with you.
Have you met many Arizona boys? I hear you speaking here for some friend of yours. Have you run into a few?
Yes, this Raymond Wimberly from Pima, Arizona. He's in my company now. And we run around a good deal together, and he's in good health.
And just as anxious to be home as you are, huh?
Yes.
Are you a combat infantryman?
Yes. Heavy machine gunner.
Oh, heavy machine gunner. Do you work right up with the leading squads, or do you bring up the next units?
No, a heavy weapons company is kind of a sport rifleman, giving overhead fire for advances on them.
But you get plenty of work to do.
Yes, you got plenty of work.
All right. Well, Billy, it's good to see you. And I imagine that Miami will be glad to see you one of these days when you get home. Well, if you'll slip away now, I'll call one of these other boys in. Billy's mother is living over in Texas, but his many friends in Miami will appreciate his message of greeting, and particularly the proxy media greeting that was passed on to the boy's parents in Pima. Our next boy's name?
Homer Cummings, sir.
Homer Cummings. And will you give me your address, Homer?
Box 924, Jerome, Arizona.
And your mother and father?
Mr. Homer Cummings and Mrs. Maggie Cummings.
And I believe you're married.
Yes, sir, that's right.
What's her name?
Marie Cummings now, sir.
Marie.
Yes, sir.
I bet she's pretty, isn't she?
Oh, I think so.
Oh, that's wonderful. Does she write you nice letters?
Yes, sir, quite often, too.
She tells you how much she loved you and all that kind of stuff?
Oh, yes, sir, it has all that in it.
Oh, that's wonderful. And you tell her how much you love her?
Oh, yes, sir.
You're not afraid of the censor?
No, I'm not afraid of him. I never see him.
Well, he probably says the same thing in his letter, so you should
worry. I imagine.
How you been getting along?
Fine, sir. Best of health and everything.
That's good. Well, you have a nice, ready smile. For as long as you've been with the 32nd Division, that's probably some sort of an achievement. How many months have you been with
them? I've just been with them about 2 months, sir.
Then that smile hasn't had time
to
wear off.
No, it hasn't had time yet.
Are you getting along with the food all right?
Well, at times, sir.
Then you mean to condition that by saying that at times you could stand one of those steaks like my friend was.
Yes, sir,
talking.
Very readily.
I see. Do you get any fresh meat at all?
No, sir, not in quite some time.
Uh-huh. Well, it won't be long. One of these days it'll be different.
Oh, we're hoping.
Let's have a greeting to the folks at home.
I'd like to send my love to my wife and sons And I'd also like to say hello to my mother and dad and to my aunts in that vicinity.
You're all right, and they don't need to worry.
Yes, sir, that's right.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Homer Cummings. That rounds up the quartet. Another group of four boys whose primary, number one, all-time personal interest is home, and those of you who make it home. James Burchett, Faustino Estrada, Billy J. Hill, and Homer Cummings from Eloy, Arizona, Williams, Miami, and Jerome. I want to thank these boys for their courtesy in coming into this warm studio and going through this friendly routine with us. I know you enjoyed it, especially those of you who know the boys personally, and that you'll be looking forward to our next broadcast that will bring you another group of the boys who make Arizona a place of which we are all so very proud. Until our next presentation, greetings to you from the heart of the Philippines, from Howard Pyle, and now back to Fred McPherson.
Thanks, Howard, for a most interesting interview. I've just received a cablegram from Howard, friends. I'm going to read it to you in just a few minutes. But first, now that we've conquered the island empire of Japan, I thought you'd like to know firsthand something of these islands and of the thought processes of their people. The appearance of the landscape of the inland empire is as fragile and delicate as a print by Seishu. This country, where every tillable acre is in cultivation, and where tillable acres are so few, presents an endless panorama of mountain and valley, of cherished views of sacred Fujiyama, of the Torii, the inland sea, of red lacquered bridges connecting islet with islet, of dancing paper lanterns and glittering fireflies on beautiful winding streams, of giant lacy cryptomerias, twisted dwarf pines and gorgeous chrysanthemums, of flowering cherry and plum in the spring, and blazing maples in the fall. I found the perfection of this formal fairyland, designed with such variety of charm, strangely contradictory to the suspicious, treacherous, yes, even evil natures of many of its leaders. The road to the incomparable summer resort of Mionashita, so beautiful with its gardens and pools, is as tortuous and crooked as the minds of the rulers of Japan. It's completely incomprehensible to the American mind that every one of his neighbors may be a spy, that every foreigner in his midst is undoubtedly a spy. But the Japanese believe this sincerely. And it's useless, of course, I'm speaking of the time I was there, it's useless to try to get away from a would-be inconspicuous, hissing little Jap paddling around behind one, no matter what one's errand or reason for being in Japan. Every Japanese abroad is a potential spy, sometimes voluntarily, sometimes paid. It's a well-known fact that the Japanese fishermen in Manila were exceedingly painstaking in sounding of every nook and corner of Manila Bay. They did this long ago, a completely useless task, I might add, because for 25 cents, they could have purchased a coast and geodetic survey chart of Manila Bay, scientific down to the last decimal point. That's true of Hawaii and of the west coast of the United States mainland. But no, the Jap wouldn't buy one of those maps. He couldn't conceive a nation so naive that it would sell accurate soundings of its strategic ports to all comers. The Japs are too suspicious to believe it. They firmly believe that we printed the charts to fool them. So they worked night and day to make their own. And that's just one facet of the Japanese mind. By boat and by train and by motor and by rickshaw, I traveled up and down Japan trying to understand their philosophy of living. To ride a car in Japan is a harrowing experience, as Howard has told you. The chauffeurs drive, or I should say they did drive, like mad through the streets that are so narrow that pedestrians had to make a mad dash to avoid being run over. From one end of the archipelago to the other, all roads were a moving mass of humanity, where no one seemed to give precedence, and bicycles and rickshaws and handcarts dotted here and there, all in the greatest confusion. Every street was filled with color and sound and motion. Smiling butterfly girls in colorful kimonos clop-clopped on wooden gaitas over the uneven pavement, and I bought sushi and taifu from handcart peddlers and from men with baskets swinging on long bamboo poles. And I saw the whole thing, but I didn't understand, and I still don't. And I don't think any other Occidental does either. There are months of great anxiety ahead for the American people. Every bit of news from Japan will be scrutinized for some hint of what the people of that occupied country are thinking. We have at least a rudimentary understanding of the German mind, and for that reason, our task of remaking Germany is somewhat easier. But Japan is an enigma. Indeed, her whole civilization has been carefully planned so that it will be an enigma, an impenetrable mystery to foreigners, especially foreigners from the Occident. So far, it's been impossible for our correspondents to determine just what attitude the Japanese are taking toward their conquerors. On the whole, they seem to be extremely cold and aloof. But that was to be expected when the first occupation troops arrived. It may be no more than a front that will wear off after the first shock of defeat and surrender is passed. However, there does seem to be one thing that we can say with some degree of certainty about the Japanese. It is that they attach not one bit of blame to Emperor Hirohito for starting the war, for losing it, or for bringing down upon Japan the greatest defeat and disaster in her long history. For instance, there was the statement of Saijo Masagawa, chief of the Foreign Service of Japan's official Domai News Agency. He should know the Japanese mind if anyone does. And he told us, "We do not attribute any responsibility for the defeat to the emperor. The stigma of losing the war will fall on those men who actually directed it." Then there was the rather pathetic mayor of Yokosuka. He even went so far as to drink a toast to President Truman to prove his goodwill. But he also insisted that the Japanese stop fighting only because the emperor told them to, that they would have fought to the last man if Hirohito had let them. Of course, there were those mysterious pamphlets, probably dropped by kamikaze pilots, that urged the Japanese to fight on in disregard of Hirohito's order to surrender. The fanatical authors of the pamphlets, whoever they were, said the emperor had been ill-advised and didn't know the real conditions. But it's safe to say the overwhelming majority of the Japanese would be acutely shocked at heretical talk like that. The attitude of the masses apparently is that insofar as the end of the war and the return of peace is good, Hirohito deserves the credit. But for the loss of the war and its consequences, he's not responsible at all. Perhaps it just isn't human nature, anywhere in the world, for a nation to admit it was wrong. What we must watch for in Japan is not so much a sudden wave of penitence, but indications that the people are taking upon themselves the responsibility for their actions. The familiar word for that healthy frame of mind is democracy. Politically and morally speaking, democracy is completely unknown in Japan. Our job is to teach them the meaning of that word, democracy. And when we do, and only when we do, the peace is won. God help us to make it soon. And now, I have a cablegram from Howard Pyle. It's dateline Tokyo via RCA. September 2nd, aboard the battleship Missouri, total peace is now official in the Pacific. I have just witnessed the signing of the final documents from the flag bridge of the battleship Missouri. General Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces, conducted the ceremony throughout and signed for the Allied Powers. His manner reflected the same calm strength that has characterized his Spartan courage throughout the worst and the best of the Pacific War. Admiral Chester W. Nimitz signed for the United States. Foreign Minister Shigemitsu of Japan signed for the defeated power. Recently liberated prisoners of war, worn but happy, were privileged to see retribution in full force. The forward deck of the Missouri was crowded with the brilliant Army and Navy command staffs, whose spectacular achievement on land, sea, and in the air have packed the most crushing power in the history of modern warfare. White-clad sailors crowded into every available opening, determined to see the climax to history that they helped to make. The sky was overcast, but no rain fell. The colorful uniforms of the visiting Allied delegations gave a smart international touch to the proceedings. The Russians, Chinese, British, French, Australians, Canadians, New Zealanders, and the Dutch all shared in the hour of triumph. The official documents were spread on a long table covered with a green cloth trimmed in gold. Drawn up before this centerpiece were the members of the Japanese surrender party. Their attitude seemed neither belligerent nor offended. Instead, every face was expressionless as they stood stiffly at attention. As the final, this completes the major color and activity of the Pacific War for your correspondent, and I have been invited, says Howard, to accompany General Wainwright on an immediate flight to Manila, where I will cover the prisoner of war picture and then return to the States. It's been a privilege to serve you from the Pacific in the closing months of a war that must never be repeated if we want civilization to survive. And that's Howard Pyle's telegram from Tokyo. And so until tomorrow morning at 7:45, when Howard Pyle will again report for the Valley National Bank to the people of Arizona, direct from the Pacific, this is Fred McPherson speaking. This is the ABC Network.
KTAR in Phoenix.